The topic of the talk today, as you can see on the slide up there, I have it on the computer here. That's why I'm sometimes looking down there. So if you might be wondering why I'm looking down all the time. So I see what is on the slide there. The topic is a virtuous cycle and vicious cycle. So we all know about the vicious cycle. And one day I was thinking about this and I was wondering about the spelling and all that. So I looked it up in the dictionary. And I was astonished and very happy to see that there is a counterpart to the vicious circle, or vicious cycle, it can be both. And that is the virtuous cycle. And then I was trying to find it in my own language. I'm from Switzerland, and the official language in Switzerland, well, we have four, but one of them is German. So I was looking at German, and in German we don't actually have a virtuous cycle. The vicious cycle exists. It's the circulus viciosus in Latin. And in German, it's called the Teufelskreis. And Teufel is the devil. Viciosus, yes. So, but what I really would like to focus on today is the virtuous part of this cycle. So this kind of word, this one single word, kind of opens up this huge world, and I hope to give you a little glimpse of that today during the talk. Right, I would like to start with a quote, and this is a quote from Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, and it goes as follows: Zwei Seelen wohnen ach in meiner Brust. And that's quite a famous quote, I think. I've also heard there is a big following of Steiner School here in Victoria. So they will know Goethe as well. So it translates to, two souls, alas, are dwelling in my breast. And it's kind of showing this fight or this kind of discrepancy that is going on in our mind. And you might have seen that. I mean, I don't know, I'm not following the news or watching TV these days anymore, but in the past when I sometimes saw these things, in movies you would have like the devil sitting on one shoulder of the person and the angel sitting on the other shoulder of the person, and they were kind of telling them what to do, and they were kind of confused and listening to both and not knowing what to do. So that kind of brings that out. But there is another story that comes from an indigenous tradition that you might have heard about that I would like to share with you in the beginning here. So that is the story of the two wolves that gives you a bit more meat on the bone and understanding how you can deal with these things. Because the devil and the angel, I don't know, it's sometimes it's difficult to recognize which one is which. And it's not just the listening, it's also the part where we actually have to act and do something. And the two wolves story is quite nice to kind of help you with that. So, an old Cherokee chief teaching his grandson about life. A fight is going on inside me, he said to the boy. It is a terrible fight, and it is between two wolves. One is evil. He is anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, self-doubt, and ego. The other is good. He is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, that's right, kindness, it's a bit small on the screen here, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. The same fight is going on inside you and inside every other person too. So here we have him teaching. And now the important part. The grandson then asked his grandfather, which wolf will win? The old chief simply replied, the one you feed. So, today I wish that it's not like this, because very often we're very confused. And if you look at the optical illusions there on the right and the left, it's hard to tell if it's going inside or if it's going outside. So if it is a vicious circle or if it is a virtuous circle. So we can often get a bit confused about this whole thing. So I'm hoping to clear up a few of those doubts today and give you a few tools how to work, especially with the virtuous cycle. Good. So we have the two sides. And here, the vicious circle is the side where we are pushed down. And things that are part of the vicious cycle could be resistance and fear. That's usually what happens in the beginning. If something arises, we start to resist, or we have fear and we turn away. We're not willing to look the things into their eyes and see what's going on. Another big one there is the fault finding. Ajahn Brahm uses this term a lot, the fault-finding mind, that is just looking for all the bad parts, for all the difficult parts, instead of focusing on the good parts as well and having a bit of balance. Disappointment very often happens when we are starting to fall into the vicious circle. Blame and shame are two big ones again on this side as well that we have to be careful of. And frustration. And from frustration often comes anger. And then when this cycle goes on and on, we have lack of confidence, which can also lead to hopelessness and helplessness, and then even lead into very, very low energy states, which are called depression. So this is kind of the vicious cycle side. Now, on the virtuous cycle side, these are things that are lifting us up, that are inspiring us, that are helping us. This could be courage. And I think courage is something very, very important, especially in the beginning. And it kind of counteracts what we had on the other side with fear and resistance. We have to be brave. We have to be courageous, because it's not easy to deal with some of the things in life or with suffering or things that happen to us. But we have to be courageous to be able to see what's going on and to hopefully solve the problem there. Then humor is another good one that really helps. And Ajahn Brahm, my teacher over in Western Australia, is very, very good with that. Humor relaxes you, a smile from another person. It relaxes yourself, it relaxes the people around you, and it gives you a natural distance from what is happening. With humor, you can also laugh about yourself. You can laugh about the circumstances, and you don't take your life so seriously. And that is very important in giving you a bit of perspective. Tolerance is another very important one. And tolerance is kind of the first step. Tolerance is realizing that there's different views, there's different ideas, there's different feelings people might have in their minds, and to just tolerate them and see them for who they are. And this can then lead into acceptance. But it's very important that we do the first step, first of all. Sometimes we want to, you know, do something beautiful and brilliant, and we jump into it too quickly, and our heart is not really into it. So we have to do it step by step, and tolerance is the first good step. And then we can move closer to acceptance. Then a few other things that are very important on the virtuous cycle are also hope. In Buddhism, we often talk about sadha and faith and hope that are kind of connected together. And again, it's a first step that leads into trust. Trust is something that has to be built over time, slowly, slowly. And we start with all these other things, and they lead towards the next ones. And then that, of course, when it starts to work, you gain confidence in yourself, you realize what you're doing there, what the teachings are offering you is actually working. And the confidence leads to inspiration, and hopefully it also leads to a commitment. And that's what is happening with the sila, with the precepts that we were chanting before there as well. When we actually see that the positive things that we're developing are working, then we're starting to get inspired, and we're starting to be committed to this path. Good, so that was just kind of a bit of an overview. Of course, there's many vicious cycles and many virtuous cycles, but I wish just to pick one out on the negative side and one of the positive side. With the cycles, it's always one thing leading into another thing, leading into another thing, and that's what creates this cycle. The interesting thing is, if you do go on Google, and that's what I did, and I looked for virtuous cycles, most of the ones you find there are actually about business and how you can kind of get your customers. And then if your customers are happy with you, then you get more revenue. And with more revenue, you can build your business or whatever it is. And I mean, okay, it is a cycle. It's a positive cycle. But if it's that virtuous, I don't know. I want to pose a question mark there. Anyway, so let's start with a negative cycle here. Some of the words will come again, but something happens, and very often we react with frustration to whatever is happening there. And this frustration usually, after a while, will lead into anger, into irritation, into anger. And anger kind of naturally flows into blame, because when we're angry, we're kind of looking for the fault, we're looking who the person is that we have to get, and we're kind of projecting outwards. The blame can also happen inside, of course. We can be frustrated or angry with ourselves, but the blaming is always happening at that stage. And with the blame often comes the shame. Now, these two words are quite close together, and one of the psychologists, Dr. Brené Brown, she kind of makes a very nice distinction there. So blame is if you realize I have done something wrong, I've made a mistake. If there is shame, it's I am a mistake. So it is going deeper. It's going kind of like the problem is not a process anymore or something which has happened. It's an internal thing. And shame is really, really, really toxic. So blame is not very good either, but kind of, you know, if we see, oh, we've made a mistake, and then we try to correct the mistake, that's fine. But please, please don't go further down that track, because it's really, really kind of dangerous, and it really pulls you down. And then from the shame, what very often happens is because we think about ourselves very bad, in a very bad way, we don't have confidence, a disconnection happens very, very naturally, even though it's not good, it just happens naturally. So if you feel you're a bad person, you don't feel like you want to be around other people, or you don't feel you're worthy to be around other people, and then a disconnection happens. And with the disconnection comes a feeling of isolation. And with isolation, unfortunately, very, very often, we go into the very, very deep kind of low energy states that are called, or that we today call depression. And the depression is, you know, like, yeah, really low. In topography, it's when you're really, when it's not a hill, but it's really low down. And all these things, they lead into unwholesome behaviors. I just put that in there because it's kind of a collective term. It could be addictions that arise because of these things. Or it could be, as I was saying, self-loathing or really feeling bad about yourself. And then these things lead into frustration again, lead into anger, and it's just going around and around and around and around in circles. So we're trying to avoid this, of course, but the first step of avoiding things like that is actually knowing what's going on. So you can step on the brake. But the best part is always to go on the opposite end, to the virtuous cycle, that is kind of the main topic of today's talk, and to follow that. So one of the beginnings, I think, for Sila and for the virtuous cycle and for many, many things is humility and humanity. So please don't mix this up with humiliation. It doesn't have anything to do with that. Humility is the noun for being humble. And humble just means to actually know who you are, to actually know what is happening, and to have courage to accept that. So we basically know that we are not perfect. No one is perfect in this world, and it's okay to acknowledge that. The other side of humility is pride. And if people are proud, basically it blocks their progress. So we're really trying to get out of that loop and have humility and then also humanity. We realize that we are not the only ones that are, from time to time experiencing suffering in this world or experiencing difficulties in this world. This is normal. And that's what the Buddha was saying. That's the first noble truth about suffering. There is suffering in this world. And it's okay to suffer, because that's kind of what happens in this world. But we can deal with it in a good way. And the first part is being humble and kind of seeing that you are not alone in this. This will lead to acceptance and also to patience, which are two very, very important qualities. And it happens quite naturally. You know, if you don't feel alone, you accept yourself and you accept other people for who they are and for what is happening in life. And this in turn then can lead to caring and to kindness, two very important things as well. You are open and you are also connected. So in the other cycle, we had the isolation that is happening, the disconnection that is happening there. And if there is this open and connectedness, then you also have the opportunity to feel love and belonging. And this in turn will help you to gain respect and to recognize what is going on. Respect is something really, really important as well. Even if we have arguments with people, even if things go wrong in life, we should never lose our respect for other people, because that's what gives us the connection, the relationship that helps to grow, that helps to learn, that helps to find a solution. If we don't respect what the other person is doing, then we basically dismiss them, and we dismiss also the opportunity to grow and to become a better person. And that's hopefully what we are all in for here in this life. Good. And that, as we saw before, leads to confidence and commitment, because you realize, wow, this thing is actually working. These five precepts, they actually do something for me. Or these teachings that we hear from the Buddha or wherever, whatever virtuous things are there, they are actually helping us. And that in turn leads to wholesome behaviors and wholesome thought patterns. And then the cycle goes round and round and round and round again. So that's just one that I picked. And there is one kind of super example in the suttas, and I just couldn't go around that one. And it is starting with virtue. And the sutta is called Volition. It's from the Anguttara Nikaya. I'll just read that out for you. Bhikkhus, for a virtuous person, and I've always underlined the things that will be the virtuous cycle thingies there. So, bhikkhus, for a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no volition needs to be exerted. Let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous. For one without regret, no volition needs to be exerted. Let joy arise in me. It's natural that joy arises in one without regret. For one who is joyful, no volition needs to be exerted. Let rapture arise in me. It is natural that rapture arises in one who is joyful. For one with a rapturous mind, no volition needs to be exerted. Let my body be tranquil. It is natural that the body of one with a rapturous mind is tranquil. For one tranquil in body, no volition needs to be exerted. Let me feel pleasure. It is natural that one tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, no volition needs to be exerted. Let my mind be stilled. It is natural that the mind of one feeling pleasure is stilled. By the way, this is Ajahn Brahm's translation, so the word is samadhi there. So they put concentration, but I took the liberty to change that to stillness and stilled. For one who is stilled, no volition needs to be exerted. Let me know and see things as they really are. It is natural that one who is stilled knows and sees things as they really are. And the Buddha carries on. For one who knows and sees things as they really are, no volition needs to be exerted. Let me be disenchanted and dispassionate. It is natural that one who knows and sees things as they really are is disenchanted and dispassionate. For one who is disenchanted and dispassionate, no volition needs to be exerted. Let me realize the knowledge and vision of liberation. it is natural that one who is disenchanted and dispassionate realizes, well, they're disappointed in the world as well, realizes the knowledge and vision of liberation. Thus, bhikkhus, the knowledge and vision of liberation is the purpose and benefit of disenchantment and dispassion. Disenchantment and dispassions are the purpose and benefit of the knowledge and vision of things as they really are. The knowledge and vision of the things as they really are is the purpose and benefit of stillness. Stillness is the purpose and benefit of pleasure. Pleasure is the purpose and benefit of tranquility. Tranquility is the purpose and benefit of rapture. Rapture is the purpose and the benefit and purpose of joy. Joy is the purpose and benefit of non-regret. And non-regret is the purpose and benefit of virtuous behavior. So we went up the virtuous cycle and down the virtual cycle. Now the last part is really nice. Thus, bhikkhus, one stage flows into the next one. One stage fills up the next stage for going from the near shore to the far shore. So I've just visualized that for you here. We have another virtuous cycle here, sorry. So we start with virtue, sila. It leads to non-regret. Non-regret leads to joy. Joy to rapture. Rapture to tranquility. Tranquility to pleasure. Pleasure to stillness. Stillness to knowledge and vision of things as they really are. Then disenchantment and dispassion. And then we have liberation here. So you will see in this cycle there is so much joy and rapture and happiness. So if people are going to say that Buddhism is a grumpy, I don't know, suffering path, they should really have a look at this sutta here. And if you follow this one 100% as it is described in the suttas, of course you go to liberation, and once you're liberated, you're not going around anymore. You've basically broken the cycle. But it works in daily life as well. So we have virtue, the five precepts, we do something good, and all these good things follow. They flow into each other. We don't need to exert any will. It happens naturally. It's a natural process. There is no self. It's just conditioning that is rolling on. And then we are liberated from the unwholesome states. And that will encourage us to be more virtuous and to practice different virtues that we haven't practiced. And then it goes round and round and round and round. And we kind of spiral out of samsara that way. Okay, good. So I've been teaching the teens group and also the Zitizen group about the four great efforts. And the four great efforts are great to actually come in here because they give you the tools how to work with wholesome mind states and how to work with unwholesome mind states. We do have the sutta here first, and what bhikkhus is right effort. Here bhikkhus, a bhikkhu generates desire for four things. Number one, the non-arising of unarisen, evil, unwholesome states. The abandoning of arisen, evil, unwholesome states. The arising of unarisen wholesome states, and the last one, number four, the maintenance of arisen wholesome states for their non-decay, increase, expansion, and fulfillment by development. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. This is called right effort. This is from the analysis from the Anguttara Nikaya. It's the analysis of the Eightfold Path, and it goes through all the factors, and this one is the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path. Right, I used to be a primary school teacher in the past, so I like to work with pictures and things, so I've put that in a few pictures for you. So we have the negative side, first of all, and that's what we have to let go of. So the unwholesome, unskillful, negative, and harmful qualities in the mind. And we have the other side, that's number three and four. Do you see it? Yes, okay. That's the wholesome, skillful, positive, and beneficial states. And that will come later. Good, so let's start with number one. So the first one, we are dealing with unwholesome states here, and this sign is very international, and I think everyone knows what that means. It's the escape sign, it's the exit sign. So with the first great effort, and the unwholesome state hasn't arisen yet, it's not there yet, but you're kind of on the edge. So you might have feelings that start arising in your body and mind that are not nice, and they are a warning sign. And the warning sign helps you to avoid or to restrain. So I used the example of the fire hazard and the fire danger we have here in Victoria, or, well, all over Australia, really. But the monastery is up in the Newbury Buddhist Monastery is up in the Wombat Forest, Wombat State Forest, and the fire risk is very high there. So when we do get an extreme warning for that day, we do evacuate. So that is a good point for you to remember. Even if you know something will be coming and you can avoid it, it's good to go before the fire actually comes and hits. So to avoid it. To restrain things, it was very inspirational to hear about stroke patients and how that works for them. So stroke patients very often lose one side of their body. And what I've heard, what they do in those hospitals, and they have the good side, let's say it's the right side for them. So what happens, those patients are starting to use their right side all the time because it's so much easier. So what the people actually do in the hospital, they'll restrain them, they restrain the right hand so that the left hand, which has to learn to do things, is starting to become more active. And that is often what happens as well. We have habits in our mind that are there and that are very strong. And it seems very easy for us to use those habits, like using our right hand, which is still okay. But it's not really wholesome. It's wholesome. It's not really helpful. So we restrain that part. And it's a bit harder in the beginning to use the other hand. But if we do that, we gain control over that hand. We gain the benefit of having that hand. And then in the end, we end up with two hands and we can use both sides of our body again. So that's the first great effort. The second great effort is this one here. So we're still dealing with unwholesome states here. And what we're trying to do is to overcome them. And once we have overcome them, hopefully to abandon them. Personally, I feel this is the hardest one because this means you are in an unwholesome state. You are in the vicious cycle. And as you saw, it's so automatic at times that it is very, very difficult to get out of it. It's good if you can have wisdom, and wisdom will help you to let go. But very often, when you can use the other great efforts instead, it's much easier to use them. And another part, when you're actually caught in it, we often think we can just let go of something. But that's a bit of a myth. The replacing of things, it's much, much easier. So if you know what the wholesome states are, you are trying to develop the wholesome states instead, and they will kind of help you to balance the unwholesome state and to get you out of it. For me, it's a bit like a computer. You have a program that is running on the computer and you can't do much about it, but you can put another program on, and on some stage that will kind of overrun that program. But we often forget that the replacement there is very important. We think, oh, this is beautiful, we have this teaching, and you just love everyone, and you just let go of everything, and it just doesn't work. So please do the replacement step first of all. Good, so that was the unwholesome side. And then we of course have the wholesome side of things, and that's when we are trying to develop and cultivate and grow these things in our mind. And at this stage, the wholesome state hasn't arisen in our mind yet. So we're kind of inviting it in. We're encouraging it to come and stay with us and then treat it nicely. And the other part that I feel is the most neglected one, but it's the one that is the easiest, is the maintenance and the preservance. And I've used a simile here because I was dealing with quite a lot of parents and young people and so in the past, that you often have an argument with your kids about their rooms, especially with the teens. You say, oh, you haven't cleaned up your room and it's so messy and there's washing all over the place and you haven't done your schoolwork and what. So that's kind of like you're trying to abandon and overcome things. You're in an unwholesome state already. But what you should actually do, and what I really encourage you to do, is to focus when it is good and to praise your kids for it and to give them the encouragement to put in a little bit of effort, a little bit of effort to maintain it. And it's so much easier to do that than actually leaving it going all over the place and then having to basically clean up the mess. Good. So what we were doing with the teens and the City Zen group, I took the song from the Beatles, the Let It Be song, and I've slightly changed it around because it's just Let It Be, Let It Be, Let It Be, Let It Be, which might be a bit boring. And the way we used it to remember the four great efforts is Let It Be, that's the first great effort, Let It Go, that's the second great effort, Let It Grow, that's the third one, and the fourth one is Let It Show. So just for them to kind of remember, that's what we did at primary school, you know, you sing songs to remember the letters and to remember the numbers. I had first graders, by the way, it's many, many years ago, but old habits and old conditioning dies hard. Good, so let's have a look at these things in a bit more depth. We still have a bit of time. Now, usually what the Buddha does, he picks the negative parts first and shows them to us and then gives us the positive parts. And I think that is done in order for us to realize, aha, there is a problem. We have to become active. We have to do something. So he says, oh, there is a problem. And then he kind of shows, ah, there is a solution to the problem. But what psychologists have found out is there is a thing called the negativity bias. And that basically means that when you have a negative experience, it weighs much, much more than a positive experience. So that's why you have those three smiley faces there with one grumpy face on the other side, and they're actually the equal weight. Psychology even suggests at times that you have a ratio 1 to 5. I remember when I was a layperson, they still have the magazine in Germany, it's called Geo. And they were talking about this, and they were talking about relationships, and they said, in a relationship, you should praise your partner 5 times and maybe tell him off once. And then it's a balance there. But if you tell him off twice and don't praise him at all, then he will remember that, and your relationship will be really difficult. So that's why I chose to turn the whole thing around and to talk about the positive things first, and that is also what I would like to really ingrain into your brain there, that you remember the positive things, the positive virtuous cycle much, much more than the vicious cycle. And just to explain where this comes from biology and neurobiology, in the past, when we saw a sable-toothed tiger, which is a negative experience, we really had to remember that, because you have one chance to get away from the sable-toothed tiger, and if you don't, that's it, you're gone. With the positive experiences, with finding a mate or finding food or getting some kind of happiness, if you go without food or without a mate for a little while, it's not nice, but you survive. So that's why our survival instinct is primed to treat negative things like Velcro, so it sticks to you, and the positive things like Teflon, so they kind of bounce off. But these days, there's no sable-toothed tigers around anymore. We are pretty safe, but we still remember the negative things much, much more than the positive things. So the Dhamma can really help us here to remember the positive, to enforce the positive, and that's what the next part of my talk will be about. So, encouraging wholesome qualities. Just a few qualities for you to have a look at that I collected there. Good. I think we all agree they're wholesome qualities and they're good qualities. But now the crux of the matter, how do we practice to encourage these things? And the Buddha has given us some advice here as well. And I want to focus on two Pali terms. The first one is hitta or hitaya, and the second one is sukha and sukhaya. For the people who come to the monastery, I think we don't do it here in Newbury, but in Western Australia, there is a stanza that people are reciting. And the stanza at the end goes, hitaya sukhaya, and it translates to for our welfare and benefit for a long time. So in order to encourage and grow these qualities, we have to see their benefit, and we have to see that they are giving us well-being. And well-being is something more than happiness. Happiness is something that happens very quickly and goes away very quickly again, but well-being is something much, much more sustaining, that makes a happy life, that gives purpose for your life, and that really helps you in hard times as well. So hitta can also be translated as welfare, useful, good, a blessing, or a friend. That's why I put those friends there. So if you treat your positive qualities like friends, be kind to them, invite them in, give them food, they will stick around. So that's one of the first things you can do. And the well-being part there is the happiness and the comfort that arises from them. When I was Googling to find a picture for this, I used the German term Geborgenheit. And it's one of those words that doesn't try to translate into English. As I was saying before, we have the virtuous cycle in English, but we don't have it in German. But in German, we have Geborgenheit, and it doesn't really exist in English. But it basically means what you can see this cat is experiencing there. It's complete safety. It's complete surrender. It's complete happiness. You just feel so at ease with someone or with a situation that you can completely relax. And I think that is what kind of well-being is about. You feel happy and safe with yourself. You feel happy and safe wherever you go. And that's what the Buddha was calling this thing of non-regret. If we are virtuous people, if we are truthful, we are not afraid, because there is no grounds to be attacked. There is no grounds for other people to attack us. We know that our virtue is very strong in helping us there. Good. There is another few terms that the Buddha used, often together, and they go like this. And as I was joking to the teens group and to the City Zen group, he's a bit of a rapper here. It's Pakandati Pasi Dati Santi Tati Vimuchati. They kind of fit in together nicely, but they do arise together in the suttas as well. They in many, many suttas, when you kind of go to Sutta Central or somewhere, you will see they arise again and again and again. And this is the process, how the mind gets used to something, how it gets close to something, and how it gets released. For positive and negatives, by the way. So the first one is to leap towards. So we spring forward, we jump to these things. So we should really know these positive things. And if they do arise, we should, you know, go close to them. It's a friend. It's something good for us. So really jump towards it. Then the second one is pasidati. And that means become bright, pleased, purified, cleared, and devoted to whatever the mind object is. The next one is stand still, remain, be fixed or settled. So that is the tranquility we had before. It happens naturally because you feel confident, you feel happy, and a relaxation happens and you stay still. There is nothing to think about. There's nothing to do. And then what happens is vimutti, that is the freeing, to be released or to be emancipated. Now, important here to know is this works for negative mind states as well. So if there is negative mind states and we are used to them and we kind of, there's some pleasure or something to get there, we sometimes jump to them, even just because it's a bad old habit, then we become confident, we kind of become pleased with them even at that time, and then we settle on those ones. But now the big difference here is what we are freed from is the wholesome states of mind, because we're so engrossed in an unwholesome state of mind. So please practice this on the other side. And on the other side, these terms are often used for meditation as well. So you have the feelings that arise in meditation, you have the object of meditation that is there, that you should be leaping forwards to, that you should be jumping towards, and then you become bright. That's what happens with the mind. It becomes purified, it becomes clear, and it becomes stilled. And then what happens there is the release, the freedom. And the freedom here is the freedom from the five hindrances and is the freedom from the unwholesome states of mind. Another nice simile that Ajahn Brahm has been teaching in the past and that really kind of struck a chord with me and that fits in here very nicely is the simile of the photo album. And that comes with these four terms, with recognize, appreciate, savor, and treasure. And to remember, how does that work together with those with the simile? So you first have to recognize there is something to take a picture of. And these days people have their cell phones on them all the time, so take it out, take a picture. But these days people are sometimes taking too many pictures, isn't it? And the good old photo album times are gone as well, so I might be a bit outdated here. But what happens once you've taken all those pictures and once your iPad or whatever it is full of pictures, you have to delete a few and you have to kind of choose the ones that really mean something to you. And that's where the appreciation part happens. Once you have appreciated them, you will take them and put them in an album. And then the next step is the savoring. So you have them in their album, you take your album out every now and then, and you savor your old memories, your good times you had, and you remember them. And then, of course, if it's an album that is really important to you, then it's something you treasure. You give it a nice place in your house, and put it in a treasure chest box or whatever people do these days. And so that's what is happening with the positive emotions and the positive mind states as well. The good thing here is it doesn't really work with the negative things, because I haven't really seen people who put pictures of when they failed their test or when their partner dumped them or when someone died and put those ones in an album. So this really works well for the positive mind states there. Oh, my goodness. Sorry, that's a bit embarrassing here. Maybe I didn't switch off the Wi-Fi. Oh, it's a message. It's a message from your body. Okay, let's have a look.
Imagine that you own $1 million racehorse, a horse worth $1 million. Would you let that horse stay up all night, work all day, drink alcohol, smoke cigarettes, and eat junk food? No? Okay, would you treat a $20 dog like that? How about a $2 cat? No? Well, why do you treat me like that? Oh, hi. It's your body here. Allow me to reintroduce myself. I'm the home that you've always lived in. Surely you remember we grew up together. And I'm writing this letter because I feel neglected in this relationship. Very disappointed in what I've been seeing. With your ambition to make money, you sacrifice my well-being, which makes no sense in the least. Because when I get sick, you sacrifice that same money to recuperate me. And what's even more ironic is, with all your interest in profit, you can't even see the truth. That I'm worth over $1 billion. Don't believe me? Okay, I'll prove it. If someone came to you with a check for $1 million, right? And said, here, all I want in return is your eyesight. You will never be able to see another sunset for the rest of your natural life. Would you take that deal? Okay, let's up the bid. Suppose he had a check for $10 million instead. And if you accepted, you would no longer have use of your arms or legs. Would you take that deal? I can answer that for you. No. See, those are silly options because you know that as your body, I am worth over $1 billion. And don't get me started with the heart. I mean, if I was a company, right? This heart wouldn't get employee of the month. It would get employee of the life. Because throughout your entire existence as a person, your heart never stops working. Even when you're sleeping, it doesn't stop beating. That's every second, every minute, every day. And come to think of it, I can't recall you ever saying thanks. Anyway, I don't want this to come off as rude. Just asking for a little attention here, dude. I know you try to make me look perfect when you're Instagramming, but we both know you've been taking me for granted. Consider this an opportunity. After this video ends, don't click to the next one like you do usually. Take some time by yourself, just you and me. Place your hand on your chest and say thank you to your heartbeat, to your eyes, legs, arms, to your hands that you use for climbing, to your lungs that bring you breath without you even trying. I do it all for you, cause you come first, cause you're my homie. We go way back, don't we? Like birth? I just think it's time you start treating me what I'm worth.
I actually came across this YouTube video because he also did a video about the anger eating demon, the story that comes from the suttas and the story that Ajahn Brahm often tells. But that maybe that's for another occasion there. Good. Thanks a lot, buddy, for mentioning that. You're right. We should actually get back to you. So if you ever want to know how to write to your body, here's the email address. And let's write a little message. My dear body, sorry, I just forgot to mention you. Of course I appreciate you deeply and value all the hard work you do for me. In fact, every time I meditate, I give you my full attention in the beginning. Also, during the day, I take time to care for you as best as I can. I'll meditate and spend some quality time with you again soon. Love, your mind. Okay, sent this one. There we go. Okay, just the last sutta to round this one off. And the four great efforts. Effort is one of those words that is very often kind of misunderstood, and we think we have to control things and do things and get things done. And this sutta gives you a very nice perspective on this. So I'm actually inclined to call the right effort factor right inclination factor. Right, bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he has abandoned the thought of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of non-ill will, which is basically loving-kindness, he has abandoned the thoughts of ill will to cultivate the thoughts of non-ill will, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of non-ill will. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of non-cruelty, which is compassion, he has abandoned the thoughts of cruelty to cultivate the thoughts of non-cruelty. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of non-cruelty. This is basically the second factor of the Eightfold Path, the right intention. And again, for the people who know Ajahn Brahm, he translates nekama, the renunciation there, as make peace. The next one is be kind. And the third one is be gentle. So because we are running out of time anyway, we are not going to focus on the negative stuff, but that's actually pretty good. That's what I was trying to teach you all along this day, or this morning, to really, really incline to the wholesome mind states. And if you do that, there is a natural process, there is a natural virtuous cycle which starts working, and that will take you out of the vicious cycle and propel you towards a good life and hopefully Nibbana in the future.